Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with regional and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Former Paradise resident Craig Heath was a journalist, teacher, and technical writer. At age 14, he knew he wanted to be a novelist. 50 years later, he published his first novel, Where You Will Die. That was in 2022. That 2022 book was the first in a series of philosophical mysteries that take place in a fictional Sierra Nevada foothills town that Craig Heath calls Eden Ridge. The town of Eden Ridge was modeled after pre-campfire paradise, California, where the author and his wife lived for 21 years. Today I'm going to ask Craig Heath about his second Eden Ridge story, Killing Buddhas. Craig Heath, welcome.
Hi, Nancy. Thank you. It's great to be back with you again.
Now, you say this is the first in a series of philosophical mysteries. What is a philosophical mystery?
It's sort of whatever I say it is. I've had trouble sort of finding the right niche, a really clear genre definition of what these books have become. And so one of the first reviews from Kirkus used the phrase philosophical mystery. So boom, I just kind of latched onto it because it's a bit of what I'm trying to do. You know, I like using the whole murder mystery as the action driver, you know, the plot driver. But I want to throw in a whole lot of other stuff in there, and I wrap each story around a sort of central large theme. The first one is about loyalty. This one is about idolatry, you know, how we idolize or demonize people and therefore dehumanize them. And so I'm sort of working that into each book. It started out accidental, and now I'm doing it on purpose.
Well, probably listeners are wondering, did I hear her right? She said, killing Buddhas? What in the world? Where did you get that title? I think I have an idea, but tell listeners, killing Buddhas?
Yeah. Well, there's an ancient saying in Chinese Buddhism that says, if you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him.
And yes, I had heard that, but I don't know how many people have. Yeah, I had heard that.
Right. And the idea is really kill the idea of anybody being a Buddha, a god, a savior, or whatever. We're all humans. We're all the same. We all have what Buddhists call the Buddha nature, which is, you know, it's all the same. So that's the idea. And since this one is about idolizing people, and the primary driver in this book, in this particular story, is Alan idolizes this man named Brandon Frank, who he's invited and is coming to his spiritual center, you know, to make a presentation, you know, push a new book that he's got out. And he so idolizes him that when the man comes to town and things start coming out about him that are rather unsavory, Alan faces that challenge we all face when we idolize somebody and then we see them as a human being, they begin to, you know, the clay feet and all of that. So instead of, I was originally going to call it The Buddha on the Road, but it just didn't have enough punch. So I just went with Killing Buddhas because there are several instances of that in the book.
Yeah. My guest is Craig Heath, and his book is Killing Buddhas. And he just explained that expression, which I think people have heard. I've heard, if you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him, which is a 19th century Chinese Buddhist monk who we're quoting there. Well, you did mention that we've got this guy that idolizes this person, and in the first chapter we meet, we get to know these names. So would you read a little bit of your first chapter, Craig?
Okay, just the opening part where we get introduced to, as I said, Brandon Frank is this man that Alan Wright, the main character, has long idolized, and basically he was the impetus for Alan to become a self-proclaimed minister and start his ministry. So having him, you know, come and visit is a great thing for him. So it starts out this way. Brandon Frank, thin, pale, wrinkled with age and stark naked, stood laughing at the edge of the high platform, preparing to dive into the pool below. Steam carried the tang of sulfur and salt from a nearby covered area of stone and concrete, where magma-heated water flowed into a series of large cisterns. Closing his eyes and clasping his hands above his head, he resembled an elderly priest celebrating the sacrament, wearing only the vestments in which God first clothed him. A sudden soft flapping of wings broke the silence as a large raven flew overhead, cawing at the pitiful creatures below who had no wings. From the platform, the naked man pointed and shouted, "Ha! Look! My spirit animal, trickster crow, creative raven, messenger of death!" Watching from the shallow end with his friend Hank Tate, Alan Wright could not believe his good fortune. Only 3 years had passed since he moved to the tiny mountain town of Eden Ridge and fulfilled his dream of opening a spiritual center, the House of the Universal Message. It marked the high point of a long journey. Now, gazing up at his mentor, he was amazed to be finally meeting the man who had inspired him to start that journey. 30 years before, Alan had first learned of Brandon Frank and how gleefully he spoke, of life being precious and fleeting, how we owe our best attention and care to the world, to our planet, to all life, to each other. Alan's hunger for the questions of youth was fed, reading the man's books, listening to taped lectures, and later watching his online videos. Basking in his presence for the past 2 days at Hank's spa felt to Alan like sitting at the feet of a Brahmin. Leaning forward, the man on the platform surrendered to gravity and, falling a dozen feet, knifed the water like an Olympian, only a small splash marking his entry. He surfaced, laughed, and paddled to join his friends, shouting, "Bloody hell, I didn't die!" Had Brandon Frank known death waited for him only a few miles downhill on a dark stretch of road, he might not have joked about the omen.
This is former Paradise resident Craig Heath reading from his Eden Ridge story, Killing Buddhas. And I was amused because here he is on a high platform, and that's dangerous. But okay, so he dives off. And then I was so amused when you quote him saying, "Bloody hell, I didn't die." And I knew right away, aha, this guy's British, because I had a friend who went to boarding school in England, and they would get punished if they used that word bloody.
Oh, yes. So it's a terrible curse to the Brits.
So your next line is, "Bran, you crazy old limey." So, yep, that confirmed it. Yeah, he's British.
Yes.
So
that's right.
So we get to meet these two people, Brandon the limey, and Alan, who idolizes Brandon. Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned that you describe him as wrinkled with age. So the next group we meet, and this is a group we meet, have a role in your story. And these little red hens have a role to play in your story. And listeners will hear you read about Mary Ellen, her bony knuckles and her wrinkled face. So there's a clue about maybe her age also. So yes. Would you read that section about why don't you read us who this special group is?
Okay. Real briefly, it came out in the first book almost accidentally that the major character as major as Alan himself is this group of these five women who call themselves and are known in the town as the Little Red Hens. They're just very well known. They've been around forever. They're very civically minded. They're always involved in stuff and everything like that. So they're this group that were the friends of the woman who was killed in the first book. And so when Alan sets out to find out what happened with her, with Ruth, these five women who were her good friends join in the investigation. And so it came about in the first book that they're like sort of natural amateur detectives, right?
Senior citizen sleuths.
You bet. And they are. They are, in fact, you know, they're all quite elderly. And so in this book, they're taking up the task of formally creating their own detective agency. They've decided that they like it so much they want to really do it. So that's part of one of the subplots in the book. So this little opening here to the third chapter is the introduction to them. is just a little bit of, at the beginning, just to kind of get the feel for them, to where we always have an introductory chapter where they're having a meeting, and that way we kind of get to know them all. But real briefly, Mary Ellen Woodcox rapped her bony knuckles on the long conference table and said, "Hens will come to order." She lifted her chin and set her wrinkled face to her best imitation of a Victorian-era dowager at high tea. Alan's Aunt Maria, in her capacity as house manager and chef extraordinaire for his spiritual center, finished loading the meeting room side table with air pots of coffee, condiments, and a large plate of Mexican sweet rolls called pan dulce. She smiled and pulled her cart toward the door as the women all thanked her, taking cups and treats to their chairs. The regular Monday meeting of the board of the Little Red Hens, the longtime group of Eden Ridge Friends now formally incorporated as Hens Unlimited, LLC, was to start at 11 o'clock sharp. The conference room in the main building of the House of the Universal Message, their unofficial headquarters, was warm and redolent with the scents of coffee and pastry. Outside, the cold and clouds still dominated the late morning sky. The four women were in no rush to take their seats. They chatted as they doctored their coffee and inhaled the aroma of the fresh rolls, each vying with the other to pick the best one. The elder chairwoman scowled, trying to will them into place with her eyes, but none of them noticed. "Lunch will not be ready until 1, amigas," Maria said. "I hope you don't mind, but I am only making street tacos today. I have much work to make a special dinner to serve tonight when Alan brings home Mr. Brandon Frank."
I loved your imitation of a Spanish speaker's accent. This is Craig Heath reading from Killing Buddhas, an Eden Ridge story. And so we meet this group of older women, senior citizen sleuths, and Alan's Aunt Maria is a house manager and the chef. And you tell us in what you just read for his spiritual center. So you might remind people about what this is about, the spiritual center.
Right. Well, the backstory is that for like 10 years before this, he had already become a sort of part-time minister. He was actually working with people, helping the poor, doing a lot of work in the community down in Los Angeles where he lived. And he started up an internet ministry, so to speak. He called it, you know, just the ministry of the universal message, and you know, wrote books, wrote articles, YouTube episodes, all this kind of stuff, and he became pretty popular. And he had this thing going, and his dream became that he wanted to find some place away from Los Angeles, of course, someplace nice, and build a center and call it the House of the Universal Message. So the story is that he found this place in Eden Ridge and built it there, himself and some contractors and whatnot, with the help of his friend Ruth, who had lived there for 40 odd years. So that's the setup for he comes, you know, he's this outsider who comes into this town, builds this spiritual center, which is, you know, as far as religious organizations go, it's neither fish nor fowl nor good red meat. It's just kind of his own thing. And that right away starts up some of his troubles, because he's seen as an outsider. He's kind of seen as a weirdo. You know, he's not just a minister coming in to take over a local parish or something. So as much as there are people who over time come to like him, come to love him, start coming to his weekly meetings and accepting him in the community, there are plenty of people who don't like him. And as we go through, especially this story, there are more and more people who are actually coming to really hold a grudge and hate him. And so that's how I'm setting up a lot of conflict here, is that, you know, this guy has this dream. He's realizing his dream, but in a way he doesn't realize, you know, the wake of trouble he's kind of leaving behind him.
Well, even what he calls this, the House of the Universal Message, that's rather vague. Universal Message?
Yeah.
So that raises questions right there.
That's taken from the perennial philosophy, Huxley. In that book, Huxley compares basically all major religions of the world And through this essay of comparing them all and what all of their messages are when they're boiled down, you know, to their core, is that they all say the same thing. They all basically say, we are all humans, we are all equal, we are all whatever you want to call us, children of God, we're all the same. There, you know, there is no difference between us. There is really no even gap between us, if you think about it. And the only trouble that we have with each other, you know, as people, are all the ideas we make up in our minds that says, oh, I'm better than him and she's better than her. And, you know, we need to go get them because they're against us, that whole thing. And that is what Alan has taken up as, you know, his sort of his central idea is that there is a universal message. And that's what he's trying to promulgate, is this idea that we are all one, you know, as people. And there's no differences in reality. There are only the ones we create in our minds.
That brings us back to the genre that you are creating, philosophical mysteries.
My attempt.
My guest is Craig Heath, and he has written a philosophical mystery, Killing Buddhas. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Craig Heath, and he has written a novel, Killing Buddhas. The subject of Aikido comes up, and people misunderstand what Aikido is about, and I think that's fairly typical, perhaps. Mm-hmm. And you have your character say, Aikido isn't like that. It's not about fighting. It's about peace. Mm-hmm. And yes. The person who hears this, a martial art about peace? So how do you explain that contradiction, Craig? Mm.
Aikido is in effect a modern martial art. It was created in the early 20th century by a man named Moriya Yoshiba, who was already a very, very gifted and advanced martial artist in a lot of the traditional Japanese traditions, you know, including Aikido with the sword and staff and hand-to-hand combat of various types. And all of those are based around, even though they have what's called Budo, which is a principle of being a warrior that does not have to do with, you know, hating and killing. It has to do with, you know, trying to bring justice and peace to the world. Even though they have that, they're still very what are called hard martial arts. A lot of blocking, a lot of hitting, a lot of killing moves, etc. So he became adept in those, but then he developed what he came to call Aikido, which is his own style, the highest principle in Aikido is somebody coming at you intending to kill you, you know, a big knife in their hand, whatever. They attack you, and your technique keeps them from harming you and from you harming them, and they are being held down, they've been disarmed, they're not harmed, you're not harmed, you have brought peace to the world. You haven't taken that energy of an attack and turned it back into another attack. You know, that person intended to kill you, you didn't turn around and kill them and just do the same thing. You brought that conflict to a peaceful end. That is the highest thing you shoot for. And all the techniques that he developed are based around that. And it's also based within the Shinto religion of Japan that has this principle of, you know, all things, you know, have their place in the world. So it's that's why you're right in saying that it sounds like a contradiction, because we think of a martial art as what we call a hard art, in that we're trying to block, we're trying to hit, etc. Aikido takes an attack, turns it away from itself, and renders it basically useless. It can't affect its damage.
Well, that quote that I read about Aikido not about fighting, it's about peace, that took place in a conversation with a character we haven't met yet. So who is Zach?
Okay. Yeah, Zach Featherstone is a high school student just coming up on his 18th birthday, and he's a resident of Eden Ridge. He's in a longtime family. This is an old family, the Featherstones in Eden Ridge. And he's come to idolize Alan. So like I said, there are several of these dynamics throughout the book of people idolizing or demonizing certain people. And so Zach has really taken to Alan. He goes to his meetings at the house, and also Alan is training in Aikido with his friend, Hank Tate, who we met in that very first chapter. Because he trained in Aikido years and years and years ago. Then he's coming back to it, and he's pretty high up, you know. And so Zach starts following him to, you know, and takes up Aikido with him. So he's a very, very excitable, but very confused boy. He's, like I said, he's getting ready to graduate from high school. He doesn't yet know what he wants to do with his life, but he's got this model now. He's also fatherless. He lives alone with his mother. And so now he's got this model in Alan that he's starting to attach himself to, of this is the kind of man, you know, that I want to be. And so in training in Aikido, he's learned all these ideas that actually in a later chapter actually come to help him, because there is a confrontation between him and a couple of other boys in the school. And he takes these things to heart, these ideas that, you know, that contradiction we think of as a martial art of peace means something. It means that that's what you're trying to do in the world. You're trying to make the world a better place. And so that's part of the story then is Zach's affection for an idolization of Alan, and what happens to that over the course of the book.
Well, why don't you read us that conversation that Zach is involved in your book?
Okay. I didn't mark that one out.
This is on page 26. Mm-hmm. He's talking with Haley, and sometime later, 3 seconds or years, Zach's memory came his rescue.
Yes, okay. So here, Zach is talking with Haley Stark, a girl one year his junior in school, and there's been a kind of a spark between them for a while now, and it looks like there's going to be the opportunity for them to get together for a date. And so she's kind of challenging him. She's saying, come on, what are we going to do? So then he comes up with this. Sometime later, 3 seconds or years, Zach's memory came to his rescue. Oh, I know. You can come to Alan's meeting with me Wednesday night. Okay. It's going to be epic. Alan's guru, Brandon Frank, will be there. He's signing books and he'll give a talk. Knowing how great Alan is, I bet his teacher is even better. It'll be awesome. Sounds exciting. It will be, I guarantee it. She laughed a little. With a guarantee, how can I say no? I'll ask my dad. Just sitting and smiling at her required every synapse in his brain, leaving no room for words. She stood and said, I'll text you when I know. He stood, okay, yeah. She pointed to his cup. You gonna finish that? Nah, here. Zach watched as she turned the spot where he drank to her lips and finished the last swallow of chocolate, keeping her eyes locked with his. He felt uneasy in his knees. The sensation moved slowly up his thighs. Haley slid his empty cup into hers and held them out. Taking them, his finger brushed her knuckle. He swore he felt a spark between their hands like flint on steel. She whispered, "See ya." He watched her hurry down the long corridor. Yeah, See ya. Zach forgot the final bell and the consequences awaiting him in his next classroom. Standing under the gray ceiling of winter, he closed his eyes. Alan and Sensei Hank both stressed the importance of being present, of letting experience reach inside you on every level, participating in the moment. He lifted his face to the sky and drew a long, slow, deep breath. The pine scent that was the permanent perfume of Eden Ridge seemed to the young man sharper and fresher, even at the year's nadir. The town sat nestled within hundreds of miles of wild pine forest on a ridge that rose between two deep canyons lush with oak and manzanita. The 19th century founders and subsequent generations refused to cut down any tree without good reason, so Eden Ridge barely interrupted the dense woodland of the Sierra foothill slope. Pine was always in the air, but an alert nose and aware mind were needed to appreciate the spicy gift. Zach picked up another atmospheric signal. The slightest difference in pressure or humidity or a shift of ionic polarity reached him and signaled change. The doldrums, the pioneer-era term for the usually windless gray January that settled on the community each year, were about to break. The first winds would soon cross the dry inland sea of California's Central Valley to blow into the canyons, gaining speed as they climbed skyward, then sweeping up over the ridges, swaying the trees and chasing away the clouds. Bright sunlight might appear first or cloudbursts. Whatever the weather, it was on its way, sending word ahead of its imminent arrival to those who bothered to tune in to the frequency. The change echoed in his own inner weather, a shift from stillness to movement. He opened his eyes and whispered, "Thank you."
This is former Paradise resident Craig Heath reading from his latest novel, Killing Buddhas, an Eden Ridge story. Just in case people aren't familiar with Sensei, you use that in front of Hank's name, and you might explain that in case people aren't sure.
Right. It's a Japanese word that simply means teacher or the equivalent of that, but it also has this sort of extra meaning that if you are referring to someone as your sensei, not just a teacher in the normal sense of the word, you are saying that person is somebody you follow and whose techniques and whose ideas you accept and you follow and you exercise them to the best of your ability. Generally speaking, in a relationship between a person studying a martial art and a sensei, an actual sensei, is not one of, you know, like, say, a Socratic relationship with a rhetoric teacher, where you raise questions and you challenge them and whatnot. Generally speaking, you're saying, I'm making myself subordinate to you. I'm going to accept your ways of doing things, and I'm going to follow them, you know, to the utmost. So it simply means teacher, but culturally it means a lot more.
Well, one other just minor note in that section. Haley drinks the last swallow of chocolate, and I happen to be a fan of Mexican chocolate, so I appreciated that she's drinking chocolate.
She had she has her own recipe that she wants to try.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. After a break, I'll continue my conversation with Craig Heath, and he has written a novel, Killing Buddhas. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman.
Thank you.
I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Craig Heath, who has written another philosophical mystery that takes place in the fictional town of Eden Ridge. The title is Killing Buddhas. A little farther in your story, and you refer to Brandon, this guru, the limey, Brandon, often call him Bran.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a scene that I'd like you to read also, where Brandon says, I don't trust doctors.
Mm-hmm.
And so would you read that section?
Okay. Starting from Bran lowered his glass.
Yeah, that was the Bran section lowered his glass and okay. Swirled it.
Right. So in this is the first night that Bran, his nickname is Bran, and he has come to the House of Universal Message. He's going to stay a few days in a cabin that they have there. And he and Alan now are sharing some whiskey at the end of the evening in Alan's chapel. And they're starting to talk and become closer. So at this point, they've talked their pleasantries and whatnot. And now it's going to get a little bit more personal. So Bran lowered the glass and swirled it. I know we've only just met, but I do fervently hope we can become friends. I hope so, too. On that basis, may I confide something to you, if you wish? What I said this morning at the spa about Raven? Harbinger of death, yes. The elder man seemed to age by years between one word and the next. He kept his eyes down on the remaining whiskey in his glass and frowned. It's truer than I care to say. Alan waited, watching the man struggle with his thoughts. After a sigh, Bran said, I've never cared for doctors, never put a great deal of stock in their methods or pronouncements. Alan still waited, silent, feeling what was coming as one hears a wave sigh before it gathers and crests. But now I feel what they say in my body, which is my heart. Alan nodded. The hardest working muscle in the body and our greatest weakness. Yes, seems I've overtaxed it. I was able to ignore it for years, pretend I didn't feel my strength waning, but now there's no denying it. Alan thought for a moment. Is there something that can be done? Medicine or surgery? Bran sighed. There are a couple of options, but as I've said, I've had a lifelong aversion to the medical profession. I find I can't break that suddenly. He forced a weak smile. And as you know, we all have that final appointment. Does Leo know? Yes, I confided in him completely. He's helped me in so many ways over the years. Now he's helping me approach the end. Well, I'm glad that you have someone close to support you through this. Many thanks. It's my own fault in any case. My life, well, let's just say I've not been the best steward of the gifts bestowed on me by the world. He looked up at Alan with a smile that wasn't quite a smile. Alan met his mentor's gaze. For a moment, a familiar sensation corrugated through his body, the feeling of something momentous taking place, as though massive movements in the currents of air or water had shifted his mind and body into some new capacity of awareness. When in the throes of such a luminous state, he could sometimes catch a glimpse of the solution to all woes and wanted nothing more than to capture it in some way, a word or a gesture or a symbol, and gift it to every living human. As always, the sensation came and went, and Alan was left with nothing but the memory of a moment between two heartbeats when he and all life hummed the same tune. Back in the present, he said, even the most diligent and careful gardener cannot stop the seasons from passing. Bran's smile lost its shadow. As I said before, sir, he said, raising his glass, you are a true pastor. To you and to the House of the Universal Message. To your health, Alan answered. The men drained their glasses.
This is former Paradise resident Craig Alan Heath. The title of this book is Killing Buddhas, an Eden Ridge Story. And these two men are talking, and we don't know what's going to happen, but that's rather ominous, what he's been saying, what Bran has been saying. Mm-hmm. Now, I want to go to the very... This is a series, one of a series that you're writing, Craig. Mm-hmm. And yes. I want to go to the very end of your book where Alan remembers a quip from Khalil Gibran. Do you remember that quip that you conclude your book with?
Oh,
Yeah, it's on page 376.
Oh, yeah, it's right on the very, very last line.
Yeah,
yeah. He remembered the quip from Gibran. God said, love your enemy. So I obeyed him and loved myself.
And that's the conclusion, this quote by Khalil Gibran, by Craig Heath. Now, I mentioned that this is the second in the Eden Ridge novels. And I think you're probably working on a third one now, Craig?
I am. Yes, I am. I call it Reason, Not the Need. Hmm. And the time frame between the first book and the second is only about 8-9 months. Same thing here, about 8 or 9 months later. The first one was in spring. This current one, Killing Buddhas, is in dead of winter. And then the next one is going to be in the fall. And that gives me the opportunity to have different seasons, different times of the year in the book, because I've kind of fallen into this pattern of making the town and the place and the weather sort of a big part of the story, and you know, paradise that it's modeled on had all kinds of wonderful changes in the seasons, so I get to put those in each time. So this one's coming up, like I said, it'll be in the fall, and it's called Reason, Not the Need.
Well, I'll remind readers also that this is a philosophical mystery, so there's a much that we have not revealed. We wouldn't want to spoil the fun for
the readers.
For the listeners. So, my guest has been Craig Alan Heath, and he has written his second Eden Ridge story, Killing Buddhas. Thank you, Craig.
Thanks, Nancy. Appreciate it.
Jeremy Miller is a former secondary school science teacher and currently a lecturer at Chico State University. He was a frequent contributor to Edible Shasta Butte magazine for its 17-year run. In addition to fruits and vegetables, his yard has bees, scrub jays, butterflies, slugs, gophers, moles, and earwigs. He's growing avocado trees started from pits, which he hopes will produce fruit. Today, I'm going to ask Jeremy Miller to read from his book, Slugs Don't Eat Arugula, Tales of Whimsy, Woe, and Wisdom from the Kitchen and Garden. Jeremy Miller, welcome. Would you please read what you wrote about making sauerkraut?
Success. A common recommendation made by doctors is to eat healthy amounts of yogurt after completing a course of antibiotics. The idea here is that healthy bacteria in the yogurt will help give the good bacteria in your digestive tract a boost, as the antibiotic caused these beneficial critters to suffer the same fate as the, quote, bad bacteria. Of course, the practice of eating foods with live active cultures predates both Western medical advice as well as the latest raw fermented fad by quite a few centuries. Yogurt is a classic example, as are kimchi, miso, cheese, and dozens of other culinary favorites. Not wanting my family to miss out on the latest health craze, I purchased a 16-ounce jar of raw, naturally fermented sauerkraut. While I was doubtful everyone would enjoy it, my wife and I did our best to set the stage. "Try this! It tastes like pickles!" Our elder daughter was wary, but she was a good sport and took a spoonful. Then she wanted seconds. And thirds. What about our one-year-old? Would lightning strike twice? The answer was a resounding yes, and soon she too was putting her fingers together, giving us the baby sign for more. I read up on sauerkraut. It seemed to be extremely simple to make. All you need to do is shred a cabbage, add a bit of salt, and set the mixture aside in an out-of-the-way place for a couple of weeks. I did the math. The price tag on a 16-ounce jar of raw organic artisan sauerkraut is $8.79. Local cabbage, at the time, was going for $1 a pound. By simply letting the cabbage spoil, its value increases by a factor of almost 20. It was too good to be true, and I had to try it. However, after failed attempts at fabricating my own almond butter, kale chips, and peach jam, which I ended up having to call syrup, I must admit that I entered into this project with a certain sense of trepidation. Even a couple of DIY friends who make their own yummy gourmet porridge out of native grass seed and field weeds told me that they had only about a 20% success rate with making sauerkraut. But I figured the worst thing that could happen would be creating a stinking culture of deadly poisonous bacteria in the kitchen. So I bought two cabbages from my local farmer and started chopping. The key to sauerkraut is making sure the good bacteria, which naturally exist on the cabbage, are, quote, happy, and that everything else, including airborne molds, insects, and other bacteria, have no access to the cabbage. This requires a certain appreciation for keeping things clean, ideally sterile, and this, in turn, requires patience, which is yet another perpetual challenge for some of us. Complicating matters were conflicting strategies on how to make the sauerkraut. The most common instructions call for a dinner plate and a mixing bowl, where the plate fits inside the top of the bowl. Shredded cabbage and salt go into the bowl, the plate goes on the cabbage, and a weight, like a smaller bowl filled with water, goes on top of the plate. My problem was that I shredded the cabbage first and then started looking for the right-sized plate and bowl. However, the clock was ticking. Once you mix the cabbage and salt, you cover it with a towel and then let it sit for up to 45 minutes before transferring it to the bowl where it will ferment. What happens after 45 minutes? I wasn't sure, but I didn't want my house to become the first spoiled cabbage Superfund site. There was no time to waste. It took me 10 minutes to find a couple of possible bowl plate options. In went the shredded cabbage, on went the plate. But the plate didn't fit. There was too much cabbage. Take two. I transferred the cabbage to a bigger bowl, put my plate on, but this time there was a gap of air between the plate and the cabbage. This was a no-no. So I put the cabbage back into the first bowl and squished it down as hard as I could. No dice. I just had too much material. Common sense would dictate removing some of the cabbage, but it had taken me over half an hour just to chop this stuff, and I had no desire to compost a quarter of it for want of a correctly sized container. Nor did I want to attempt two batches, which would only double my chance of failure. So back to the computer I went. A couple of websites suggested using a Ziploc bag filled with water to take the place of both the plate and the weight. Instead of a bowl, the directions called for a large glass jar. Once the jar is stuffed about three-quarters of the way with cabbage, the bag of water fills the remaining space and keeps air away from the mixture. But by now, my 45-minute time limit had expired. Panic set in, and I imagined that the contamination of my fledgling experiment had already begun. Desperate times call for desperate measures. I put the entire mess into the pasta colander and rinsed, hopefully flushing out all of the invisible, or imagined, bacterial nasties down the drain. I put the sopping cabbage back into the mixing bowl, added more salt, and then followed the rest of the instructions. By the time I placed my mixture in the cupboard, the entire kitchen, along with much of my body, looked like the aftermath of a ticker tape parade of damp cabbage shavings. It took another 40 minutes to restore order, and it was well after midnight before I got to bed. Over the next week, the contents of the jar turned from a light green to a dull yellow. I watched carefully for mysterious molds and sniffed daily for foul, non-crowdy aromas. I remained vigilant for signs of contamination, including fuzz, orange spots, and dead canaries, but noted nothing out of the ordinary. After 12 days, it was time. It is bad luck to be superstitious, but I crossed my fingers anyway as I pulled out the plastic bag. With a damp cloth, I wiped the rim and upper part of the inside of the jar, and as a precaution, carefully spooned out the top half inch of sauerkraut and placed it in the compost bin. I sampled some. It was tangy, salty, cabbagey, and satisfyingly crunchy. Miraculously, it seemed, well, perfect. My wife tried a spoonful, and she concurred that it was delicious. Our daughters wanted to try some. They loved it. 24 hours passed, and no emergency room visits were necessary. 2 weeks later, I repeated my success. And then I did it again, this time adding some shaved carrots. And then again, with chunks of daikon radish. I am the king of kraut, and my family loves me for it.
That was Chico author Jeremy Miller reading from his book, Slugs Don't Eat Arugula, Tales of Whimsy, Woe, and Wisdom from the Kitchen and Garden. Chico humorist Eric Miller, a.k.a. Etc. Guy, retired from the garbage business and now has time for outdoor pursuits and writing with the North State Writers Group. And now, here's Eric Miller.
This story is entitled Cross-Country Road Trip Tests Family's Harmony. I have found that there ain't no surer way to find out whether you like people or hate them than to travel with them. Mark Twain. What doesn't kill us makes us stronger. Just ask my siblings about our hellish 1976 family jaunt from Colorado to Georgia. We celebrated the nation's bicentennial by moving from the Rockies to Dixie. Though the Civil War ended 110 years earlier, my siblings and I were hardly civil. We were Air Force brats. We caravaned in two vehicles when Dad was transferred to Georgia. I was 13, Kirk was 11, and Lisa was 8. Dad drove our faded international travel law, packed to the ceiling, with suitcases, three kids, and their whiny cat. The rig pulled a horse trailer loaded with one horse, hay bales, a shaggy Great Pyrenees, bikes, and several cases of Coors beer. We used fairgrounds to board the gelding during stops. Coors wasn't distributed east of Colorado back then, but Dad figured out that stable hands liked beer, so he bartered using bootleg beer for paddock rent. The travel hall had an AM/FM radio, bench seats, but no air conditioning. Mom followed in her box-filled Mustang towing our boat. The Mustang had air conditioning, bucket seats, and an AM radio. Dad only turned on the radio to listen to financial talk show gurus. Boring. My siblings and I coveted the cooler Mustang, though Mom chain-smoked cigarettes and drove below the speed limit. At least Mom listened to music on the radio. We alternated rides with each parent, assisting with navigation and ensuring the trailers remained hitched. Serious battles were fought over who rode shotgun versus the back seat. Kirk hogged more space than a sumo wrestler and taunted Lisa. We barely crossed the county line when he violated Lisa's trespass warning. "Dad, Kirk's touching me," Lisa tattled. "Stop it, now." Dad kept his eyes straight with both hands on the wheel. Kirk draped his foot on Lisa's leg. She squealed. "Dad, get him off." Dad, a doctor, had an excellent manner with patients but had little patience for bad manners. I rode shotgun during this 200-mile stretch and watched the punishment unfold at 60 miles an hour. "Eric, keep it straight." I slid next to Dad and steadied the steering wheel. Dad turned to his right, leaned against the door, and walloped Kirk on the side of his head. "Leave your sister alone, or you'll ride with the horse." The repartee and reprimand continued for hundreds of miles. Kirk and I switched riding positions throughout Oklahoma and into Arkansas. Lisa never got into trouble, just my brother and I. By the time we reached Mississippi, Kirk and I occupied less than 36 square inches of back seat. We scrunched into a space smaller than a floor tile while Lisa sprawled out on a beanbag chair. No one wore seatbelts in those days, so using a beanbag chair inside a moving vehicle wasn't a concern. Lisa instigated several conflicts, especially during ice cream stops. Kirk and I inhaled our double scoop cone in seconds while Lisa's lasted 3 hours. We'd pine for a lick, but whenever we complained, we got the licking. Then one of us was reassigned to Mom's Mustang as part of a secondhand smoke clinical trial. Dad's summer tour ended, and we began our return to Colorado with a second horse. It must have been a good deal. The seller said the horse descended from Robert E. Lee's own stock. The Travelaw, now towing 900 more pounds, lost horsepower and died next to Cooter's Auto Sales in western Georgia. The breakdown tested family harmony. 90-degree heat and 100% humidity pasted clothing fiber to our skin. Mom watched us connect a hose to the car lot's faucet to cool the animals. We sprayed each other while fending off sparrow-sized horseflies. After hours of haggling with an unsympathetic Confederate, my exhausted dad bought a crew cab truck, rounded up three soggy kids, their mom, the cat, the dog, the horses, hitched the trailer, and continued west. Kirk and I and our crying cat were ultimately banished to the horse trailer the last 300 miles. We sat on hay bales and stared at the dog. It humbled us to ride this way. Kansas was especially boring. There was nothing to see except for corn stalks on the right and left and two horse asses ahead. That 1976 road trip didn't result with family canceling. We bonded. I recently road tripped to Colorado to visit family. My siblings road trip to visit their extended families in Nebraska and Wisconsin. I'm glad our road trip gene endures and that we're able to pull off these travels without needing a horse trailer. I'm Eric Miller.
And next we have a segment we call The Writer's Room, and it features writers from around the North State.
Bound Like Twins. I wrote this poem from a series of interviews I had with families who had our autistic children during the time of COVID. Ever since I can remember, I looked after my big brother at home, at school. Teachers told me, Teddy's having a bad day. What was I supposed to do? Told my mom, who tells everyone what a big boy helper I am. I'm only 10. Now, we twins are all grown up, but sometimes I think I hate my brother, who's not like other brothers, weird, talking strange, in your face. Go away. But still conjoined. Look, Ted can use the iPad. Here's how to post pictures. High fives, laugh together, eat Doritos like when we were kids. Both at the same time, joined under the same heart, beating, beating. Joan Goodrow.
For more information on the writers you've just heard, go to mynspr.org and click on the poetry link.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.